This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, May 5th, was the date originally set for Indiana's primary elections. COVID-19 changed that. In light of the pandemic, the primary was postponed to June 2nd, and several other changes have been made to the voting process in an effort to protect public health. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Here to walk us through everything you need to know to successfully vote in the upcoming primary is Secretary of State Connie Lawson. Secretary Lawson, it's great to have you with us today. We appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Matt. I'm glad to be on with you.
As Indiana's chief elections officer, you've been involved in a lot of the changes to the voting process for the upcoming primary. You've been busy. We mentioned that the pandemic pushed the date of the primary to June 2nd, but it also changed the way that Hoosiers can vote. Most notably, the option to vote by mail has been open to all registered voters. Are you encouraging voters to take advantage of this option?
Well, yes, Matt, we are encouraging people to vote by mail if they want to. And as you mentioned, we've opened up that opportunity. Prior to the Indiana Election Commission's order, you had to have a reason to request a mailed ballot. I think there were 11 reasons on the application. And we decided that in light of the virus, that we needed to let anyone who chose to vote by mail to do so. We want to keep voters safe, and we also want to keep families safe. So that's why we decided to do that. I will say that the Republican Party state chairman and the Democrat Party state chairman and the Indiana Election Division and myself, we worked really hard for 2 or 3 weeks there trying to come up with an agreement. And I think we did a really good job of modifying the election and keeping voters safe, allowing voters to vote the way they so choose.
What were some of the biggest things that came up as far as arguments against or for doing things this way? What were some of the concerns people had?
Well, as I mentioned, we want to keep people safe, but we opened up the ability for anybody to vote absentee. We shortened the time that a person could vote early in person. Prior to the order, it was 28 days before the election. This order changed that to 7 days. So a voter can vote early in person starting May the 26th, which is the Tuesday after Memorial Day. We also allowed counties to be more flexible in the number of locations because they're having trouble recruiting poll workers who are confident that they'll be protected. And we also allowed them to have some more flexibility in the way they count their absentee ballots, meaning the locations that they count their absentee ballots. So there were a number of things that we needed to get worked out, and I'm glad we did.
Okay. You just walked us through some of the steps. I appreciate it. But is postage included there, or do we have to throw a stamp on there?
No, postage is included.
Okay. And if somebody has more questions about the process, who do they contact?
Well, it's easy. You know, you can either register to vote online, which, by the way, the deadline is next week, May 4th. If you're not registered, go to indianavoters.com, and that is where you can register to vote, and you can also request an absentee ballot. And we actually developed a new process prior to the order. The way you requested an absentee ballot application was to print one out and then complete it, mail it to the county clerk. And if you were a registered voter, the county clerk would mail you the ballot, which you would then mail back. We cut out one of those processes because we thought there were so many people who will be voting by mail. And so now you can actually fill the form out online, and it's immediately in the clerk's, what we call hopper, in their county office. So that cuts out a few days of mail processing.
Hmm. So prior to this election, Indiana was among the one-third of states that required a reason to vote by mail, such as being out of the state or having limited transportation. There's a range of reasons. Mm-hmm. Now, not requiring an excuse gives far more people access to this kind of an option. Can you talk about the preparation that it's taken to make this transition possible, to pivot in such a short time? It's got to come with a lot of challenges.
Sure. It's especially challenging for our hardworking county clerks, I can tell you that. I mean, they are processing much more mail than they normally would. The good news is it's a process. It's an expansion of a process that clerks have had for years. So they know how to handle it. I would say for voters, just I would keep in mind that, you know, it takes a long time to count absentee ballots. And, you know, you have bipartisan teams. And, you know, if there's a ballot where someone can't tell how the voter intended, sometimes those ballots have to be remade. So there's a lot of things, a lot of processes in counting those absentee ballots. And it could take longer. It is not likely that we will have a result on election night, I would say, as we are up to 167,000 absentee ballots so far this year. And at the same number of days out in 16, I think we were at 28,000 ballots.
What kind of costs are involved with this kind of transition to the no-fault vote by mail? Is it an expensive one to make?
Well, there's more postage, obviously. There's probably more labor, but if the number of locations and the number of poll workers are cut down, hopefully it will be a wash for the counties.
Okay. And are there any concerns about vote by mail that you hear from the public?
Once I explain it to them that, you know, you have to be a registered voter. You can't register vote unless you have an ID here in Indiana. And that the process is that, you know, the clerk has to mail you the ballot. There are no unvoted ballots that are hand delivered by anyone. So that's part of the protection that's in the vote by mail.
And we've talked about
we're not an all mail state, Matt. So that's important to remember. Many of the all mail states, you don't have to fill out an application. You just get mailed one as a registered voter. So that's our security around the mail.
Okay, but this seems to be a step in that direction, at least for these very, very different circumstances anyway. And we've talked about vote by mail on the show before, and we heard from listeners who expressed that they preferred to vote in person at the polls. Will that option still be available on June 2nd?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, you can vote early in person beginning May the 26th, and that process goes until noon on June the 1st, the day before the election. And then on June the 2nd, we will have in-person voting. I think the caution here is check with your county. Some of the locations may have had to be changed.
Now, some of the biggest concerns around that is protecting the safety and wellness of voters and poll workers. So what measures are being taken to do that?
Well, my goodness, you just can't believe how hard we have worked to procure protective equipment, personal protective equipment. We have garnered over 4,400 gallons of hand sanitizer. We have gotten sanitization for the polling equipment. We have gloves and masks and face shields and sneeze guards, and your poll workers will likely look very different as you enter the polls. But I think what most counties will be doing, and this is, we'll be sending out recommendations. And we did have a document attached to the order on the CDC recommendations. So counties will need to follow those. But I'm sure at the very least, if I were a voter and I had a mask, I would certainly wear it into the polls. If I had gloves, I would probably do the same. But we will be providing hand sanitizer for the voter, both before and after they vote.
So this costs a little bit of money, of course. Did you get any federal support to make these safety measures happen?
We did. We applied for our portion of the CARES Act, and we did receive about $7.9 million. And the problem has been, procuring the amount of equipment that we need, but we've been working very hard, and I have an individual in my office who has done a wonderful job in procuring that equipment.
And so many of the polling workers tend to be older citizens who also fall into the more vulnerable population for COVID-19. Do you have concerns about having enough poll workers if so many of those decide that this is just too risky for them?
We absolutely do have that concern. We are allowing counties to combine locations where they just need to have one precinct board, but we're also on social media, and we'll be doing PSAs to encourage high school students, college students, anyone who's been recently unemployed to volunteer also. It is a day's worth of pay. Counties will pay anywhere from probably $75 to $150 per day for their poll workers. So it is a paid job, but it's a civic duty too, because it's a long day.
Okay. And so if someone listening right now feels healthy and is young and not exactly in that vulnerable population, who do they reach out to? How do they find you?
You can either reach out to your party chair. Remember, in the primary, we are nominating candidates to represent our party. And so when you're working the polls, you're representing a party, or one party or the other. And so if they know the party chair or a precinct committeeman, it would be good to call them. If not, call the county clerk's office. And I know that they would love to hear from you.
And a lot of states have made changes to their primaries in light of the pandemic, Indiana included, of course. But Wisconsin, however, stuck with their original date, and the country watched as they really kind of struggled to navigate a primary and a pandemic at once. What lessons did you take away from what Wisconsin did?
Well, I think the biggest lesson that Indiana took away from that is that we needed to spread the in-person voting out. I believe they only voted in person on Election Day. And so that's why we have a week of in-person early voting before Election Day, so that hopefully we won't have big crowds at any of our locations.
Okay. Secretary of State Connie Lawson, we would like to continue talking to you in the next segment. Is it okay if you hang around for just a second?
Sure.
Okay. Again, if you, the listener, have more questions about how to request an absentee ballot or mailing deadlines or voting locations, you can find all of that information and more at indianavoters.com. Again, that's indianavoters.com. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the impact that the pandemic has had, not just on voting, but campaigns as well. How do you introduce yourself and your ideas to a community from a distance? Can you organize, fundraise, or build momentum in any of the same ways? I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with that conversation in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We are back talking about changes that have been made to the voting process in Indiana on this, the day that Indiana had set aside for the May primary. Now, of course, the primary is on June 2nd. If you have questions or comments about what we're talking about today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881. Give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation today. And we are back with Secretary of State Connie Lawson with a few more questions about this big change. Now, circling back to vote by mail for a moment, the nonprofit Indiana Vote by Mail and 12 Hoosiers have filed a federal lawsuit this week against yourself and the Indiana Election Commission to force the state to allow absentee vote by mail in the November general election. And the concern is that without no excuse, so-called no excuse absentee voting extended to the general election in the fall, some voters might find themselves in a position where they have to choose between their health and their ability to vote. Will we see an extension for the general election?
I can't predict that, because I can't predict what the situation will be in November.
Okay. And is it you that makes that decision ultimately?
No, it would be the Indiana Election Commission that makes that decision.
Okay.
And, you know, I won't comment on the lawsuit. I will just say that the Indiana Election Commission orders by law are good for 30 days. So they will have to come back in and renew the two orders that they've passed. But they will have an opportunity to consider no excuse absentee later on this year for the November election.
So that is pretty much where we're going to get what you think the future of no absentee voting looks like in Indiana?
Well, no, I can't say that, because the Election Commission can suspend laws and rules in an emergency, if there is an emergency. how people can vote. But if we're not in an emergency in November, remember, we have certain laws in Indiana that pertain to absentee voting, and it would have to be the Indiana General Assembly and the county clerks who weigh in on that issue.
Okay.
Our statutes would have to be changed.
Now, this election has come with an awful lot of changes, and all of it has happened in just a few short months. Is there anything else that you want voters to know right now?
Well, I think they need to remember May 4th is the deadline to register to vote. They can do that at IndianaVoters.com. May 21st is the deadline to request an absentee ballot.
Okay.
And May 26th is the day that early in-person voting begins. And I would, again, I would just remind folks that one big difference is that we won't likely have results on election night because there's so many mailed ballots that we've received thus far.
All right. Secretary of State Connie Lawson, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Okay, Matt, thank you.
We've been talking about what you need to know to cast your vote in the upcoming primary election. And just as voters are learning to adapt in these times, so are the campaigns. Technology is allowing us to connect with one another like never before. But how helpful is Zoom to candidates trying to introduce themselves to the public? As always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, to 866-476-3881. Joining us now is Corey Wood, the co-founder of Right Voter LLC, a company that provides campaign consulting. Currently, Corey is involved in the state treasurer Kelly Mitchell's 5th District congressional campaign. Corey, welcome to the show and thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So can you tell us a little bit about Right Voter and the campaigns that you're involved with right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do campaigns all across the country, literally from presidential campaigns all the way down. We've even done some things with dog catcher races. So literally all over the map, and have done work in every single state. And our bread and butter is really congressional campaigns, U.S. Senate campaigns all over the country.
Dog catcher? Is that an elected position somewhere?
Yeah, in some states, that's absolutely right. It is an elected position.
How much work do you have to do on something like that?
Not much.
I would imagine. Okay, so we're still in primary season. There's a major general election coming up in the fall, and then the pandemic comes in and upends life as we know it. So what runs through your mind when you realize that you have to figure out how to run a campaign from home?
Yeah, it's a whole different ballgame. There's no playbook, obviously, for something like this. You know, it's just intuition, you know, sitting down and figuring out. Obviously, we've got to still talk to voters because we have an election coming up now here in Indiana. Obviously, it was pushed back a month until June 2nd. But, you know, especially in this race in a primary that, you know, 15 candidates, how do you make yourself stick out? You know, the one thing that I'm extremely proud of in this race specifically is that we were one of the first congressional campaigns in the country to go to a completely virtual format. Definitely the first in the 5th District. And you know, we were even there before some of the presidential candidates went. So that included a lot of different activities, including, you know, utilizing some telephone services like telephone town halls. You know, we've been specifically targeting certain cities and towns, you know, having local elected officials on to talk about their response to the pandemic. Obviously, when it comes to fundraisers, you know, we still have to fundraise because you got campaigns and, you know, they're expensive. You know, so we've done a lot of Zoom related fundraisers. And meet and greets to still talk to voters. It's a completely different ballgame, but I think we've been ahead of the curve, not just in this race, but all across the country and giving our candidates the best shot to win.
So normally, though, if we weren't in a pandemic right now, what would this stage of a campaign look like? What are the goals and strategies at play?
Yeah, we'd be knocking on a lot of doors. Obviously, that is not able to happen, considering a lot of your the electorate, you know, are those that are right in the crosshairs of this pandemic. Lots of phone calls, which obviously we're still able to do, text messaging, you know, stopping by restaurants and diners, shaking hands, the retail politics of it all. And a lot of that obviously is not going to be able to happen in this race, considering we have a primary on June 2nd. But in races where primaries are coming up soon, hopefully we move beyond this and can get back to the normal stages of a campaign.
So on those changes, though, how's that going? Are you able to gauge what's been effective and what's not been effective?
Yeah, I mean, it's we've had a great response, you know, still able to talk to a lot of voters. You know, a lot of things have shifted to obviously phone, text message, digital targeting folks on Facebook, Facebook Lives. But there's still an interaction. It's a little different, but, you know, it's the times that we're dealing with and, you know, we're handling it well.
Well, and so campaigns are competing for the precious attention of the public, even during the best of times. When you do have the chance to connect with voters from a distance, of course, be it digitally or over the phone, is it still hard to ask of someone's time in the middle of a crisis when people are looking for work or teaching their kids from home or worried about their health?
Yeah, I mean, you know, twofold on that. I mean, we've had a tremendous amount of volunteers that are willing to help. And it's actually, you know, been quite surprising. You know, the technology that we have actually allows, you know, volunteers to call from home. So we load up a list of voters and you know, we've got a ton of volunteers all across the country working for our candidates, calling folks. On the fundraising side, it's kind of the same thing, you know, just calling and having conversations. It's hard to ask for money, obviously, during, you know, this pandemic and people are struggling, but, you know, checking in on their well-being, checking in on their families. That's, you know, really what we've been preaching to our candidates, because at some point things are going to get back to normal. And, you know, those, building those relationships are going to be important in the long run.
So you're not going door to door. You're not holding rallies, but people are still available. People are still at home. Have you found it almost easier to get a hold of people under to a certain degree, I suppose?
Yeah, really in the beginning, you know, when things started shutting down and the stay at home orders started to go in place, it was difficult to reach people because I think people were afraid of what was going to happen next. But now that we're, you know, things are starting to be lifted, and even a couple weeks after the stay at home orders took place, you know, we began our voter contact operations again in all of our campaigns, and we had a lot of good conversations. And you know, obviously the number one issue that everybody wanted to know where your candidate stood on was where the pandemic and how, you know, if you're a member of Congress, how are you going to help me? As you've seen, you know, some of the PPP program and unemployment and stuff coming from Washington.
And so how have you been able to answer some of those questions? Did some of those catch you off guard initially as this was sort of first emerging?
No, not really. I can tell you the White House, the administration has done an excellent job of providing resources to candidates all across the country, not just candidates, but elected officials. I mean, every single day we get an email giving updates on what you know, issues they're tackling, that which we then share with our local elected officials here, mayors, city councilors, and such. You know, the NRCC, the GOP are keeping us up to date on things that are happening on Capitol Hill, which has been great. And here at the state, even the governor's office has been amazing at you know, providing us updates that we can then push out. Because, you know, once those stay at home orders actually started to be put into effect, I mean, our campaign really transitioned, and a lot of campaigns across the country transitioned into, you know, pushing out information on how people can get help. Again, like I said, the White House, the administration, folks in D.C., and right here at the State House have been extremely helpful in providing those details so that we can push those out to constituents in this district and districts all across the country.
There can't be much of a playbook here for how to campaign under these circumstances. So for how a candidate can introduce themselves and build a relationship with the public, like what we've been talking about,
yeah,
all from a distance, of course. And are a lot of campaigns just sort of figuring it out as they go, or are you talking to each other about strategies?
Yeah, I mean, well, we're keeping all of our strategies to ourselves.
Right.
We don't want to give anybody else any pointers. But there is no playbook for this. That's the key part of this. So it's kind of building it as you're building the car as you're driving it. And but we've had a lot of great success, and voters have been responding, and. Like I said here a little bit earlier, I think campaigns that are nimble enough to maneuver, these uncertain times are going to be the ones that are rewarded come election day.
Well, you've had experience with all kinds of campaigns, so I feel like I can ask you this. Do you think smaller local campaigns are dealing with very similar limitations and questions right now, or are there big differences here?
Yeah, I mean, it really just depends on the issues. Obviously, smaller local campaigns, like if you're running for mayor or city council, people are concerned about, the issues that are close to them, like potholes and those types of things. Congressional level campaigns, gubernatorial campaigns, U.S. Senate campaigns, and even the presidential campaigns, which we've also been involved in, are having to answer on the policy on how how you're going to help their family or their small business, all of which are struggling right now because of, the state of our economy, because of the pandemic. And each campaign is unique and each message is also unique.
And for all the social limitations that campaigns have to operate within right now, are there any positives or opportunities that campaigns can take advantage of right now?
Well, yeah, I mean, as things start loosening up, obviously, I don't foresee any campaign events really starting to take hold, at least probably till the end of this month, which, provides a huge opportunity, number one, to make a ton of phone calls to whether it's to ID voters, persuade voters. But also, right here in Indiana, we have, the absentee ballots. More than likely, this race is going to be decided by absentee ballots. So following up with our supporters to make sure that they're requesting their ballots and getting them returned. But also on top of that, when you look at a candidate, the candidate's job is twofold. Well, I always say threefold. Number one is to raise money. Number two is to talk to voters. And number three is to raise money. that provides a lot of opportunity because there's nothing else really going on. So if we're not doing a Zoom meeting or a telephone town hall with a potential voter for our candidate, they're on the phone talking to potential donors.
Have you already started thinking about protocols that you'll need to establish when we start to see things like rallies again and things like that?
Yeah. I mean, it's something that's on our minds every single day. And obviously, we have races in several states all across the country, and every state is at a different stage. So, we're kind of writing a playbook ourselves on what this should look like. But every campaign is going to be different just because of, the stay at home orders and restrictions are different in every state, and the timelines, are also different. So yeah, we're beginning to look at that. I think, a lot of it is still going to be what we have been doing in the past, because, even as you're seeing some of these states open up, people still aren't comfortable going, to restaurants or, to diners or whatever it may be. So, getting candidates in front of voters is still, I think, for the next few months, whether we're open 50% or 100%, it's still going to be the tactics that we've been utilizing during the beginning of this pandemic.
And of course, you've talked about how the priorities of voters have been finding out where the candidate stands on things like COVID-19 since this has come up. So has it had an impact on the policy priorities of, let's just say, specifically your candidate? I'm curious if a crisis like this causes policy to shift, or if it only just solidifies what a candidate's fighting for.
Yeah, I mean, it's across the spectrum there. Obviously, legislation that's happening in D.C. That's going to affect small businesses and families here that are harmed. you know, we're in a crisis. So everything is on the table. That's messaging that we've seen over the last few months. They're talking about an additional phase, to the stimulus package to help states and local municipalities who are hurting. Just like they just extended the PPP program for small businesses. So yeah, it's learning this really quick, but after this crisis passes, obviously, there's going to be a lot of issues that remain because of this crisis. Whether it's our debt and deficit, which have ballooned because of the needed spending that did take place, those things are going to have to be tackled. The great thing here about our state is that we are obviously in a cash positive position, which is great. But we're not at that level on the federal level. Which further proves that when you're not in a crisis, being a fiscal conservative and getting your fiscal house in order is going to be important. And those are the issues that we're kind of hearing as we're talking to voters over the last couple weeks.
Corey Wood is co-founder of Right Voter LLC. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was great to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Up next, we'll be joined by experts in civic society and political science about the broader trends we might anticipate in our elections and civic engagement in the coming months. The pandemic is changing how we campaign, but will it also shift what it is we campaign for? I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with that in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion about how elections and campaigns are being affected by the pandemic. We're joined now by Matthew Baghetta, an associate professor at IU's O'Neill School of Public Health and Environmental Affairs. Matthew, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Marjorie Hershey, professor emeritus of political science at Indiana University. Marjorie, thanks for being with us today.
You're most welcome.
And as always, we would love your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Marjorie, we were just speaking with a campaign manager about how candidates have had to make major pivots to abide by social distancing guidelines. Can you talk about what a campaign loses when you have to keep a physical distance from the voters that you so badly want to reach?
Well, that depends on the campaign. First of all, I think it's clear that canvassing is just going to be very, very difficult to do this year. Even when we're talking about November, there are an awful lot of people who are not at all anxious to see any stranger coming to their door and trying to talk at them for a few minutes. So that's going to be a problem. Rallies are going to be a problem. This is obviously going to hit President Trump harder than it is going to hit his Democratic opponent. It's also clearly going to affect what's talked about during the campaign. And I think it's been very interesting to see what's happened with the presidential campaign in that Vice President Biden has been rising in the polls as long as he has been out of the public eye. He's, by staying out of the public eye, made this more and more a referendum on President Trump and his handling or non-handling of the coronavirus controversy. So for some candidates, it's not a problem to not be able to be in the public eye. For others, it certainly is if you need to get yourself better known.
Matthew, we've also talked about how social distancing will change the way that Election Day looks with safety measures put into play. But social distancing is also going to have an impact on every day leading up to Election Day. How will this distance impact civic engagement during election season?
It's going to have a tremendous effect. Campaigns of any kind, political campaigns, local fundraising campaigns, they all work better when local communities have lots of people who are out and about and connecting with one another. And they can do that in lots of ways, through clubs or religious congregations, in public spaces like public libraries or farmers markets, in even in grocery stores when you're allowed to talk to other people inside them. And all of those kinds of things are not going on right now. So the sort of civic infrastructure that's there waiting for a campaign to step in and activate just doesn't exist. Many campaigns like to reach out specifically to organizations, VFW halls and those kinds of things, to connect with groups of voters and talk about specific issues. And those organizations aren't meeting right now. They're not coming together. They're not having their members informally meeting each other in ways other than, you know, the occasional Zoom meeting if organizations have that going on. So there's really a huge civic deficit that that's going to be faced in this campaign season.
Marjorie, I think it's interesting that you said that this sort of pause on this big campaign year might actually have a benefit for major candidates like, well, you mentioned Joe Biden. I mean, under what other circumstances could the lack of public public-facing interaction be beneficial to a candidate like this?
Well, I think obviously candidates who are less well-known are who have yet to introduce themselves to the voters are going to have a tougher time, if I can go at your question in the opposite direction. There are a lot of candidates who are running for the first time. For them, that's really a problem. Incumbency advantage is less than it used to be during the 1980s, early 1990s, but it still exists to some small degree, and that's going to mean that challengers are going to need to work especially hard to overcome the incumbent's advantage through name recognition, through having the resources more readily available to be able to conduct a full campaign. So that's going to make a difference. It certainly should make a difference in a partisan sense as well, just in that we've seen some pretty interesting partisan differences between those who believe that it's safe to go out and the economy is more important than public health, and those who believe the opposite. So it may be that Republicans will have an easier time getting those civic orientations and canvassing and various other kinds of person-to-person activities that Matt was talking about started.
So, Marjorie, what alternative tools then for public engagement are campaigns kind of leaning on right now? And do we have any insight as to how effective they are?
Well, I think the learning curve has been a real challenge for a lot of campaigns. YouTube, various kinds of social media have been the obvious way to substitute for face-to-face meetings. That's a challenge, as any of us who have been involved in them have certainly noted. It doesn't provide the same kind of group pressure that you would want when you have a fundraising gathering in which some people are saying, yes, I'm going to write checks, and that kind of spreads to the other people around you. It's a little bit tougher to do that on Zoom, and it's impossible to do that on YouTube. So the kind of generation of audience support that comes from being next to people and sharing their enthusiasm as it's expressed are going to be really hard to recover.
Matthew, can we talk a little bit about fundraising here? How might we expect fundraising to be impacted right now? So on the one hand, we have there've got to be voters that are more motivated than ever to have their voice heard. And then on the other hand, I'd also imagine small dollar donors might be in a tough spot right now.
Absolutely. Campaigns are reaching out, as Professor Hershey noted, in ways that they have been doing in recent years, using, you know, mail and email and, you know, Facebook ads and those kinds of things to generate clicks and donations. But the flip side of that is with record levels of unemployment and lots of people in very tenuous economic circumstances, those people are probably much less likely to, you know, be willing to put some money down for a candidate this year, just because they're not as able to do so. And I think there are going to be some interesting implications of that, because there are people who are still working. There are people who still have their jobs. They may be working from home. It might be more difficult for them to do it. But they still have the income to be able to make donations. And I suspect campaigns are quickly going to realize that those are the people they need to talk to the most to try and generate more donations, which may well mean that some of the policy issues they talk about and are putting forward in this campaign season are going to start skewing in that direction. It may well be that people out there are in desperate need of additional unemployment support. But if they're not the ones who can contribute, and the people who can contribute are the ones who have jobs but are struggling to work because they have children at home while they're trying to work, we may see candidates start talking more and more about policies to address childcare issues and perhaps less about those unemployment issues, because the people with the childcare issues who have jobs are the ones who are going to be able to contribute more during this campaign.
So when a candidate sees a shift in who they're getting donations from, that has an impact on some of the policies of the candidate. What about when we look at higher dollar donors versus the smaller dollar donors who would be, you know, the ones fueling a lot of campaigns right now, but they aren't giving? Would that cause more candidates to pay lip service to some of those higher dollar donor issues?
Certainly. And I actually think we heard Corey Wood hint at that in the last segment as well. The idea that if the candidate can't be out going door to door and canvassing and doing very visible public events and rallies, you know, perhaps their time is better spent making phone calls. Well, if you're going to have your candidate making phone calls, you want that candidate to spend their time making phone calls that are going to generate the most resources and the most support for the campaign. That means probably spending time making phone calls to people who can donate the maximum amount to your campaign and might be willing to make additional donations if they really care about the things you're talking about to PACs and other organizations beyond your campaign. And so we may well see candidates spending even more time in these shelter-in-place situations talking to high net worth donors, wealthy donors who can support at very substantial levels, and doing less to court the small dollar donors that have been talked about quite a bit more in recent campaigns.
We are talking about go ahead, Marjorie.
Let me just add what Professor Baghetta just said is a very important point, and it's also added to by the fact that in very recent years, it's easier for large donors to put more money into campaigns than it was in the past since the 1970s campaign finance reforms. Congress modified the total amount that could be given by an individual to candidates, political parties, national conventions, and other groups, so that now one individual couple could put as much as $1.5 million legally into a campaign and a set of party treasuries. This is something that was illegal prior to that. There were limits, and there still are limits on the amount that you can contribute directly to a campaign. Increasingly, people are putting money into an area where there are no limits, and that's independent spending, where you give money to a super PAC or you run ads yourself. Those, according to the Supreme Court, are unlimited by law. And so when candidates go after big donors, the big donors can give them even more or contribute even more to independent spending than they could before.
So in a way, Margie, could we be seeing through the pandemic an exacerbation of what some believe are the problems that are caused by these sort of loopholes in political spending?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we haven't had any shortage of that problem in the past. We've had a lot of inequality in terms of the development of campaign spending and the consequent attention to the kinds of people who give big donations by Congress. Even in the stimulus packages, there were some pretty impressive benefits given to the most wealthy, even though those are not the people, obviously, who are worried so much about losing their jobs or having to pay for childcare.
Matthew, there's often an energy to successful campaigns and this sense that you're building momentum. So will campaigns be able to do this and get that momentum to harness it without public rallies and events? Or is that we remain to be seeing?
I think it's going to be very difficult. There will have to be some sense of momentum that will be generated over the course of this. But I think, you know, especially depending on how long these sort of social distancing orders remain in place, it could be very difficult for them to get a sense of that. A big part of what gives a sense of momentum for a campaign are media stories and media coverage of rallies and other public events, of large groups of people coming together, because that's a signal that lots of people are interested in a particular candidate or a particular idea. And, you know, in the absence of that imagery, it's going to be very difficult for candidates, I think, to communicate quickly and easily to the public that lots of people are out there supporting me and you might want to get on this train as well.
So we're not gaining momentum in the same way. So then how will the public be able to gauge where candidates stand in relation to each other? In what other ways?
I think we're going to see, you know, partly things that we've seen for quite some time, a tremendous amount of television advertising. With people more isolated and spending more time at home, we will see ads really saturating markets. And we've seen that in this campaign already, even before shelter-in-place orders were in place. So I think we'll see a lot of that. And the question will be just how much people are willing to put confidence in what they see in that kind of advertising. After that, we're going to see, you know, for social media users, they will gauge based on, you know, the kind of traffic and support that they see on social media. But there are still lots of people who aren't using social media or aren't using it in those kinds of ways. And for those people, it's probably going to come down to, you know, the small number of people that they are seeing, that they are communicating with, their immediate social networks. What those people think is going to be how we are going to be able to judge what we think is going on in the broader world. We'll just norm ourselves to the people we are talking to and the people who are around us.
Marjorie, will the pandemic itself have an influence on the decisions that a voter makes at the ballot? I'm curious if this is a moment where voters reevaluate their voting priorities, or if perhaps they double down and take advantage of the unique situation we're in.
I think it's important for us not to overestimate the importance of campaigning in the final outcome of an election. We tend to do so naturally because the campaign is what's changing every day. And so we assume, obviously, you know, people wouldn't be putting all this effort into campaigning if they didn't think it made a difference. We find, however, that way upwards of 90-95% of Republicans and Democrats will vote for the candidate of their party if he or she says that they will fly off to Mars for the weekend. You know, really, the partisanship is extremely strong right now. Polarization has increased to the extent that an awful lot of people hate the other party to the extent that they absolutely would not vote for a candidate of the other party. We see some fascinating poll results that show that a substantial majority of Republicans think that all Democrats are socialists, and a substantial majority of Democrats think all Republicans are racist. In a case like that, there's not a whole lot of room for movement by the campaign.
Marjorie Hershey, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. She is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Indiana University. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're most welcome.
Matthew Baghetta is an Associate Professor at the O'Neill School of Public Health and Environmental Affairs at IU. Great to have you as well.
Thanks for having me. It was great to be here.
And once again, if you have questions about how you can cast your vote, go to indianavoters.com. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.